Welcome to the Well Technically podcast. I'm Simon Lamb. A couple of weeks ago, I attended Microsoft Build 2016. And this podcast is going to drill into all the things at Build that I was super jazzed about. So we'll start with the highlights. And if I don't get too much hate mail, then we'll drill into some more detailed podcasts in the weeks to come. Enjoy. Here's the situation. I'm on holidays in Queensland, and although I love my kids and my wife and my sister-in-law and my mother-in-law, I'm really excited after Build, and I just wanted to throw this podcast together to give back to the guys at work some of the things that I learned and that I'm excited about. The only thing to keep in mind is that I'm hiding up in a room to keep away from the screaming kids. And it's really hot, so I'll have to do this in stages so I don't melt. All right, so basically, I was just going to go through the keynote because there's a whole lot of really exciting stuff that happened during that. I basically took a whole lot of notes, and I'm just going to go through those notes because they're all the things that caught my attention. So I guess the first thing was Windows Hello in apps and websites. So as part of the anniversary update, so that's the next update of Windows 10 coming soon. There's a whole lot of additions, and the first one which really caught my attention was as I said, Windows Hello in apps and websites. So you can now leverage Windows Hello in your own apps, and also even on a website. And they showed a demo of like a banking website that used the Windows Hello logon to authenticate. And this is really interesting because it means that you can now, there's now a potential to get to that kind of one identity store in the sky being an Azure Active Directory. And then you can use multiple means of actually authenticating. So PIN, face, picture, all the things that are available to you within Windows Hello. So that one's really promising. The next thing was Ink Workspace. So they've gone crazy with the kind of inking functionality within Windows 10. So it used to be in the previous versions of Windows, you'd press the little button on the Surface Pen, and up would pop the OneNote modern app or Windows Store app, which was cool. But if you preferred to use the OneNote desktop app or anything else, it wasn't much chop. So in the anniversary update, this Ink Workspace is a new feature where when you press the button on, say, the Surface Pen, a little kind of start bar looking thing over on the pops up from the system tray, and it gives you a whole lot of options. So it shows your recently used inking apps and a whole lot of other features. It was pretty cool. So that one was also pretty exciting. Along with that, the ability to draw with the pen, and also the addition of stencils and rulers. So they have this kind of virtual ruler that you can bring up on the screen, and it looks like a normal ruler. It looks crazy, like a plastic ruler, and you bring it up on the screen, and then the pen will actually snap to it virtually. Well, it looks so real. It was really cool, but it allowed you to now draw perfectly straight lines, and there was the potential for stencils, so you can draw all sorts of custom shapes and with the ability to snap to the edges of it. So what else? There was a along, I guess in addition to that, there's a whole lot of stuff for maps. So in the maps that kind of tied into the use of inking, because you could now show a map and you could draw a custom route from the source to a destination on a map, and then throughout the map you could actually draw billboards. So they're like little notes to allow the person who's navigating on the map to notify them of some kind of information around that point on the route. And the cool thing was when they actually even showed the rotation of it in a 3D model, the actual billboards rotated with the rotation of the map, which was really, really cool. Okay, so what else? They also announced some pretty big growth in the Windows Store, and as part of that, and the push on the universal Windows platform, they announced a Facebook Messenger and an Instagram UWP app that will be coming very, very soon. I've had a quick look around, and I can't actually see it on the store yet, so. It must be coming soon, and in fact, there's a beta program for Facebook for Windows 10. I'll chuck the link to that Facebook beta in the show notes. But along with that, there's also the promise of an advertising SDK to allow you to leverage the Facebook advertising functionality within your own apps. So looking forward to that as well. As well as on the actual day of build, the Visual Studio 2015 Update 2 was announced, and I hear we're already requiring that back at work with some issues with VSTS and builds automatically flicking back to Git or something. So we've already had to install Update 2 if you want to go and play around with build definitions in VSTS. Beyond that, there's also the anniversary update. SDK preview was also announced at the same time. The next announcement that got a crazy response from the crowd, obviously a lot of web developers in the house, was the addition of the Bash shell into Windows 10. And although a few people were poo-pooing this because it was using some kind of virtualization technology, they'd be incorrect, and Microsoft, working with Canonical, another company, has actually mapped the Bash shell to all the underlying Windows APIs, which means that it's natively working, which is really cool. And it even has all the Bash tools like apt-get to allow you to just go and download any tool. And they did a demonstration where they went and grabbed Emacs and they showed the functionality within the shell. It works, works normally. They would go and edit a file using Emacs. It was pretty cool. So you could potentially use the Bash shell to fully interact with your computer. I hear that the integration between the Bash and then going to a native PowerShell shell doesn't actually exist. So I have to do some further research on that, but yeah, look, it's really exciting, and obviously people were really into this announcement because it got a real reception. Now the next announcement, since I'm an Android guy, it was really interesting. So the Action Center in the cloud, they're calling it. So basically, it would allow us to have notifications on multiple platforms. And when you receive a notification and you dismiss it, it will dismiss across multiple platforms. So at the moment, I think the platforms were Windows, Windows Phone, and Android, which was pretty exciting. That also led into the announcement of notifications from Android to Windows 10, which is really cool, because it means that There was some initial implementations where, say, you could receive a text message and natively in Windows, you'd be able to reply to that text message and send it back on Android. So, and as part of this, I've been reading a lot of blog posts where people were suggesting that if you didn't want Continuum, then it's really tempting to go with an Android phone if they're kind of bringing those ecosystems together. So I'd keep an eye on how this one pans out. Now the next few topics kind of centered around the bridges. Now I've been watching the bridges for a while now, the Centennial Bridge and the Westminster Bridge, but now the first one they had a look at was the hosted web apps. So this was otherwise known as the Westminster Bridge, and basically it allowed you to wrap an Apex around a website. So you can just take any website and basically take that website and turn it into a Windows Store app. So and that has some real implications for how you do deployments. So any changes you make to the website are automatically deploy down to the app because it's just pointing at the website. But also within the JavaScript on the website, you've got access to the Windows Store API. So you can interact with things like the camera or other hardware devices on the actual computer like you're a native Windows Store app. So it also allows you to get that website and have a presence in the Windows Store, which is really cool. Along with that, they then started talking about the desktop app converter. So this is to do with the bridge was called the Centennial Bridge, and basically allows you to take old school Win32 apps and convert them to new modern Windows Store apps. Now this has some limitations, like the apps that are once they're converted will still be running in a user under a user context. So if you've got apps that are say running as a Windows service and are kind of like a singleton style app, like you can only have one of them running on the box, then this probably won't work for you. But it still has some real significant implications. And some significant opportunities for people with old school Win32 apps to now be able to deploy using the Windows Store, to have the security of the Windows Store, to be able to leverage like say toast notifications and a whole lot of things that you traditionally couldn't get in a Windows 32 app but could get in a new style Windows Store app. Now there's a couple of ways of creating these new Windows Store apps from existing Win32 applications. The first was going using the desktop app converter. So this would basically create a Docker container and then run your installer within that container, looking at any kind of file I/O or registry access that it did as part of the installer. So then it could package that as part of an Apex installer and reproduce that when you go and install the converted app. The other way was to use, if you use Wix to go and create your MSI, you can basically, you can go and generate the Apex using Wix now instead of a traditional MSI. I think the next cab off the rank was probably heading into the world of the Cortana Intelligence Suite. And this started with I guess the latest Cortana integration that you could put into your UWP apps. So basically what that kind of entailed was to allow you to say launch a foreground app with voice commands, and it can specify targets and specify parameters that you'd pass within to the app. You could launch background apps with voice commands as well. You could interact with a background app that's already running, and most importantly you can deep link into a background app, so you can pass all sorts of information in so that you can actually jump to a specific place within the app rather than just launching it and then having to have the user navigate to where they wanted to go. And there's all sorts of natural language voice commands that can be extended so that you can basically say the app's name anywhere in the command rather than launch app name, for example. The next thing I was intrigued about was Cortana for other mobile operating systems. So I tried it once before, but I didn't really love it. And that was Cortana running on Android. So I thought I'd have another crack, particularly since apparently the Cortana app for Android is a key part of what you'll require to work with notifications that I talked about earlier. So yeah, I've chucked it back on my Android phone, and it's actually pretty cool. Like, I'd even hazard to say that the voice recognition is probably better than Google Now, but obviously needs a little bit more testing. But so far, yeah, loving it. Now, in the keynote, they kind of talked about the Cortana intelligence suite being three main things, being the bot framework, the cognitive APIs, and machine learning. But if you go and look at CortanaIntelligence.com, it's actually a lot bigger than that. And if you go and look at the intelligence suite and how they describe it, it's those Cortana integration pieces we just talked about. It's the bot framework. It's the cognitive APIs, Power BI, and its dashboard and visualizations, machine learning, HD Insight, stream analytics, SQL data warehouses, big data repositories, and a whole lot of event hub and data orchestration features. So I'm not sure if I'm quite clear on what the Cortana Intelligence Suite is. It seems like a collection of a whole lot of tools which are all useful within their own right. I'm trying to figure out how it all fits together. So I guess that understanding is to come. I guess a key part of that suite was the bot frameworks. And so they were able to do a pretty cool demonstration where they were using bots in line within Skype, but the bot framework's not specific to Skype. It's basically any kind of text-based communication medium, whether that's Skype, Slack, Office 365 Mail, or they actually even showed a demo where all the communication was done through standard text messaging, so a request and reply based interaction, where the bot was purely on a traditional SMS platform. Now, some of the cool examples where bots were being used started with more service-based models, where the bot was providing some kind of information back to the consumer of said service. Some of the demonstrations that I saw were Bing search bots, Bing news bots, the caption bot. That was really cool because it could summarize it. You could basically upload an image to it, and it would summarize the image and provide some kind of caption describing that image. And then a summarized website bot that you could point it at a web page. It would read the web page and try and understand it and give you some kind of a summary of that web page. So it's these kind of functions that we start to see the teaming up of bots and the cognitive APIs. So I'll throw an URL to the cognitive services in the show notes. But if you played with Project Oxford or the How Old Am I demos or Twins, you probably would have seen these services which have now been rebranded into the cognitive APIs. So some of the cognitive APIs, like the emotion API, which could basically from text to detect whether you're happy or sad, so you can use it in kind of surveys. The face API for identifying faces, computer vision API, which was for distilling information from just any image. There's speech API for converting speech to text and back again. The language understanding and intelligence service, so that's Lewis, so it's teaching your apps to understand commands from users. And on top of that, the second example shown was like brokered conversations. So that's when the bot would actually go and speak to another human or speak even to another bot to perform some kind of activity. So someone sent you a message asking you to have a meeting at 10 o'clock. The bot could then receive that, understand it, ask you whether or not you wanted to have that meeting at 10 o'clock. You could then respond, and it would respond to the other human that asked you the question. Or if it detected that you're in a city due to your scheduling, it could then go and speak to a bot at a nearby hotel and reserve your room, or speak to a car hire company and rent you a car. The possibilities were really amazing. So that was really cool to see. In fact, it was just really awesome to see these bots and the cognitive APIs coming together to provide a heaps more natural interaction with a computer that's based on understanding rather than just straight up automation. And there was even the possibility of determining when the bot couldn't understand what was going on. So that gave you the opportunity to possibly escalate to a human in scenarios where the bot was having trouble understanding the human interacting with it. Now let's change tack a bit. So I guess the big wow moment for me was that Xamarin was now going to be included in your Visual Studio license. So for people who were perhaps trying to decide to go with React or Cordova or go with Xamarin, this, I would assume, changes the landscapes substantially. So we've done a whole lot of work back at Fred using Xamarin. But the price was always, I thought, was a limiting factor. So if you're going to have to decide whether to do your next project in Cordova and have to learn web skills or continue on now with Xamarin, this made things a hell of a lot easier. And I guess the license went all the way from Ultimate all the way back down to the Community Edition. So that's really neat as well. I actually spoke to a mate at Xamarin and he alluded to the fact that if you'd purchased a Xamarin license in the last 3 months, then they would potentially refund it. And we're going to look at doing something special for the people who had purchased it prior to that. Well, next up, let's talk about Azure Functions. Now, a little while back, Amazon, AWS, did the same kind of thing, and they called them a Lambda Functions. But basically what they are is a small piece of logic that you're going to put up in the cloud and execute it based upon certain events, such as someone hitting an endpoint or a scheduler. But there's a pretty low cost of entry to this because you don't need to write them in Visual Studio. You don't need to deploy them up using MS Deploy. You just use the portal, and you can either write in C# or Node and test them within the web portal, as well as having some level of auditing and monitoring ability. So look, they were pretty cool because if you just want to do some kind of web job with a low barrier, to getting them up and running, they're a fantastic way just to move those functions into Azure, and you're not paying for a virtual machine, or you're not paying for a website, you're just paying for compute. And if you go and check the Azure Functions website, which I'll throw in the show notes, you'll notice that the first million calls are free. So, like, I'm not even going to touch that. So I'm really excited to have a play with these. we're hitting the home stretch now. But the next kind of GA announcement was in regards to Service Fabric. Now, I'm not going to admit to knowing heaps about Service Fabric. I've been listening to a hell of a lot of podcasts about it for like the last year. I know that, well, this it suggested that a lot of Azure, the actual framework, is built upon Service Fabric. And when people talk about Service Fabric, it's talking about a way to make all your microservices in a way that that you don't have to write the code for dealing with issues such as reliability, scalability, latency, and deployment. The framework gives you a structure and a way to do this without having to write it yourself. So a service fabric environment would allow you to do like auto scaling, has like self-healing facilities, integrated health monitoring. So I'm going to be looking into this intently in the next few months. But right now it's hit GA, and they showed a fantastic demo with the game Age of Ascent, which is almost like an actor frame, an actor pattern, but it was a whole lot of different entities flying around in spaceships, and it showed how you could upgrade a individual entity without taking the game down. So it was a pretty amazing demo, and I encourage you to go out and have a look for that. I'll throw the video in the show notes as well. And I'll wrap up with some reporting / BI / database related announcements, particularly for the guys in the architecture team back at my company, who would definitely be interested in this stuff. Look, they're probably already all over it. But there was initially some announcements related to DocumentDB, which I know we're heavily investing in at the moment. The first one was the ability to have geo-redundant DocumentDB. So for that kind of extra level of redundancy, you could spread the DocumentDB around multiple fault-tolerant data centers, which was cool. The next big one was the MongoDB drivers. So now the DocumentDB can fully interact with a MongoDB client. So that means that any clients or any applications or solutions that were built against MongoDB, you can now potentially throw them straight against DocumentDB and have the same kind of outcome. But the final one, which really made me sit up my chair, was the announcement of Power BI Embedded. Now, what this seemed to be was an embedded solution where you can now run Power BI inside any of your own applications. But the interesting part was that it's based on a service which you only pay for what you use. So, and in fact, you don't even have to authenticate with a Power BI account to use it. So, your actual application handles the authentication and receives app tokens, which can then be used to request data. So the users using your application don't even have to have Power BI accounts. Now, I have to drill into this in the coming weeks and seeing how that relates to our current requirements for authenticating what data they see. But I spoke to one of the guys at the Power BI, asked the experts. Stand, and he said that it currently doesn't work with if you're using like tabular cubes at the back of your Power BI, which we do use, and that's currently not supported. As a lot of our kind of authentication and security challenges are related to those tabular cubes and the fact that we need to authenticate against a local domain, I'd be really, really intrigued to see whether using of these app tokens and this kind of abstraction of the user away from Power BI will give us some solution in the future to be able to do this in a simpler way. But actually, that's probably about it. If you've stuck through to the end of this, I applaud you. It was actually a lot harder than I thought to do a solo podcast without anyone else to kind of bounce off. So, yeah, look, I appreciate you sticking it out. If everyone wants me to continue, we'll do some new podcasts soon. I'll leave it up to you. Thanks so much.